Case number 12-1463, Broadcasting Board of Governors, Office of Cuba, Broadcasting Petitioner versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. Mr. Scherer for the petitioner, Mr. Hennigy for the respondent, and Ms. Self for the intervener.
May it please the Court, my name is Howard Scherer. I represent the petitioner in this matter, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Office of Cuba Broadcasting. With me at council table is Betsy Parrish from the Broadcasting Board of Governors, who worked on this matter below. I'd like to try to reserve 2 minutes of my time, if I may, for rebuttal. This case involves the covered by doctrine, a defensive doctrine in which an agency argues that its contract with the union already covers.
Defense to what?
Defense to a contention that there is either a statutory or contractual duty to bargain midterm.
Well, what case has said that it's a defense to a contractual duty? Your own brief cites one of our cases that says it's defense to a statutory duty. Is there any case that's held that it's a defense to a contractual duty?
No, not yet, but I think that's the error.
Not yet.
That's
very helpful.
Well, I don't think we need that, because I think that's the central problem in this case, both from the jurisdictional point of view and the merits.
But why is that even? Let's assume you're even right that it is. Don't we just look at the authority's decision to determine whether we have jurisdiction? And in this case, the authority expressly said that it was not deciding the statutory question. Doesn't that just end the case?
And that's the error. Well, I think that's the error that we're pointing to that the authority made.
But the authority decided that it was not deciding the statutory question. It was only deciding the collective bargaining agreement question.
And you
would agree we don't have jurisdiction over that, right?
The jurisdiction over the contractual?
If the authority's decision was based on not based on the statute, not on an unfair labor practice, we lack jurisdiction, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So my question is, even if you're right about the doctrine, footnote 5 expressly says we are not deciding the statutory question. And, you know, in ACT, our case, we said we lack jurisdiction even where the authority discussed and even mentioned the statutory question, which is what we have here. I just don't see how under the statute and our case law interpreting the statute that we have jurisdiction here.
Well, as this court said in the NTU case at 452 F. 2nd, the authority has a de novo duty to review the covered by doctrine decision to determine how broadly or narrowly a contract should be read vis-a-vis the covered by defense.
Here it decided the case on an alternative ground. It ruled that the collective bargaining argument theory could sustain the decision, and that's what it rested its decision on. It said that was a separate and independent ground for the decision.
And it seems to me you can't decouple what the contract means from the covered by argument itself.
They clearly overlap. You're absolutely right. But the FLRA could have decided this either way. It could have decided it as a statutory question or as a collective bargaining interpretation question. It chose the latter. Therefore, we lack jurisdiction.
Well, in that regard, the authority in making its contractual determination, which I have to emphasize again, this court has already said, the authority has a de novo duty to review how the covered by doctrine applies in
that
case.
That's in a case in which the authority decides there's a ULP. Then it has a de novo obligation, correct?
That's correct.
But here they didn't decide there was an unfair labor practice. So the obligation to consider what happened below on that issue doesn't apply because they're not resting on that.
Well, the only way they get there is by not looking independently at the contract and determining whether or not, as we maintain below, the contract itself covers the very bargaining issues that were raised. And it just
Do you have a case that says that the authority has an obligation to do that when it's reviewing a decision of an arbitrator that can rest independently on a collective bargaining finding? There's no case that says
that,
right?
Not yet. But that's the
key. That's what you're looking for here, right?
No, I am not. I'm not even looking for that exception.
It's inconsistent with our precedent.
No, I think it's. I think, in fact, your precedent actually supports us here in a number of ways. And that's because the covered by doctrine arises out of the statute.
Which case supports your position?
Well, let's start with NTEU at 399 F. 3rd. That, and then also I would say Judge Edwards' decision in the Navy.
NTEU. Now, was that reviewing, I'm looking for my notes here, was that reviewing a decision of an arbitrator on an unfair labor practice issue?
No, it was an unfair labor practice issue, yes. Yeah.
Okay, that's not this case.
In this case, if you'll give me one second, sure. I'll try to explain that. The midterm duty to bargain arises either from the contract, if read by the authority, or it arises from the statute. And if from the statute, it's because of 7114A4. Our argument in this case below was to the arbitrator and then to the authority, we don't have a duty to bargain here because of the covered by doctrine. We say Article 30 and the contract in general covers the issue of bargaining over RIFs. We bargained over that. We established an article. And that, under the covered by doctrine, gives us a defense to having to bargain midterm. The authority never looked. I'm sorry, Judge Boyer.
You argued that you can't decouple the contract from the covered by doctrine, but doesn't that cut the other way? The contract has been interpreted by an arbitrator, and the authority reasonably affirmed the arbitrator's decision. We have very limited review of that. And so you're resting on a misreading of the contract, but that seems to me to be an issue that's very hard for you to get access to, given the posture of this case and given our limited role.
So as a matter of law, I think the arbitrator made rulings that are inconsistent with both this circuit and the authority, and the authority's decision-making on covered by, and it's right in the first page of the...
But we're reviewing the decision of the arbitrator here. We're reviewing the decision of the authority.
Right. I think Judge Pollard's question, though, had to do with... If it's a contractual question, I'm out because the authority defers to the arbitrator, and if that's what she was asking, I'm trying to respond to that. So I think on page 494 of the Joint Appendix, the first page of the authority's decision, it makes this statement in summarizing the arbitrator's decision. After considering the testimony of union and agency witnesses, the arbitrator found that the parties had agreed that such bargaining would occur, notwithstanding the existence of the parties' agreement. And then it went down and said, and the arbitrator, in addition, found that the agreement could not cover all possible appropriate arrangements that the parties could negotiate. Well, the first part, summarizing the arbitrator's decision, indicates to me very directly that the arbitrator went past the language of the contract to look at extrinsic evidence without giving the covered by doctrine defense the proper scope of consideration. And then, in its only reading of the contractual language, said it doesn't cover all possible appropriate arrangements. Well, this court ruled that that was improper back in Judge Edwards' decision in the Navy Marine Logistics case at 962 F. 2nd. That would bar all covered by doctrine application and would require bargaining in all cases.
But the agency said they weren't reviewing the covered by conclusions of the arbitrator because they weren't resting on that. So if had they been, you might have an argument. Let me ask you a hypothetical about this. Your position is that covered by is always a defense, including to a contractual claim. Is that right?
It can be. I don't know the full extent, but in this case. In this case, it requires the contract to be read and is a defense to bargain.
So if the union had not mentioned an unfair labor practice at all in its grievance, not at all, and the arbitrator had not mentioned an unfair labor practice at all, not at all, and it came up to Flora, and Flora says, we have to defer, and instead it relied only on the contract. Flora says we have to give deference to the arbitrator, which is our rule also. Would you still say that was wrong, that they should have de novo reviewed under the covered by doctrine, even if no one had ever raised an unfair labor practice argument?
If we had not raised the covered by doctrine?
Not you. If
as long as we had, I think that definitely requires or involves, implicates, as this court has said, the unfair labor practice parts of the statute.
Even if there had been no claim of an unfair labor practice?
Yes, because our point would be, as in the Federal Bureau of Prisons case at 654F3rd, that we've already bargained over this subject matter. We don't have a duty anymore, and here's the contractual provisions that show it.
So when you say that implicates an unfair labor practice, you mean a statutory unfair labor practice?
Correct.
I thought your position was that the covered by doctrine applies even in a purely contractual world where the union is disavowing and not relying, and the arbitrator is not relying or mentioning ever an unfair labor practice. I thought your position was that the covered by doctrine nonetheless applies, and that therefore, even in a purely contractual world, the authority has to review the contract de novo, notwithstanding the arbitral award, because that's what the covered by doctrine would require, and that what you're asking us to do is say that the authority was in error by failing to apply de novo contract review to the arbitrator's contract in order to implement the covered by doctrine. Is that not your argument?
Well, it is my argument with one minor amendment, and that is if the arbitrator had actually interpreted the contract in this case within the four corners of the contract, I would say my answer would change a little. But here the arbitrator...
How would it change?
It would allow the authority to defer at least to the contract interpretation, but not to the implications of that contract interpretation for the covered by doctrine.
Your real problem is the use of the parole evidence rule by the arbitrator. Is that right? In interpreting
yes.
a contract.
Going into extrinsic evidence when this court has clearly stated...
Let me ask, is there any case yet which has held that the agency cannot defer to something where covered by applies, just any contractual argument, cannot defer to an arbitrator's reading of a contractual provision in which the arbitrator uses parole evidence to go outside the four corners of the contract?
So your case in the AFGE case at 470 F3rd, which we quoted, mm-hmm. involves just that, and it was the union.
Was it a contractual case, or are you?
It was a contractual case in which the argument was that there was a failure of the duty to bargain, and the agency had defended on the basis
of... Failure of the duty to bargain under the statute or under the contract?
Well, under the contract, and it was called for contract interpretation, the authority looked at the parole evidence submitted by the agency mm-hmm. to render...
Unfortunately, we've got 50 cases that are called...
This is an AFGE case at 470 F3rd. I'll get it for you exactly, Your Honor. So this is American Federation of Government Employees, Local 2924.
Okay, got it. Yep.
In this case, this is the drug testing rehab safe harbor case. And you made the argument that what the firing of certain employees is contrary to the contract. The arbitrator refused to go beyond the four corners of the contract to render what the arbitrator understood it to mean. The authority went just the opposite direction and actually looked at agency testimony as to what the agency thought the contract meant. And this court said that was absolutely wrong. You start with the contract. You look at the four corners. You cannot create an ambiguity by looking beyond the language of the statute. First identify the ambiguity. And then you, in that situation, could. But in the case I just cited, the court couldn't find an ounce of ambiguity. And so it said the contract interpretation rested with the plain language.
Was there an arbitrator in that case?
I believe this was a ULP, so it involved an ALJ.
Yes, so that's a different question. The question I asked you is whether there is a case. There's a special rule about how the agency has to defer to arbitrators' interpretations of contracts, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so that's not what this case is about. This case is about the agency itself in the form of the ALJ and then in the form of the FLRA interpreting either correctly or incorrectly a contractual provision. But that doesn't raise the same issues that arbitration raises.
Well, completely overlap, but it does instruct, Your Honor, because here the authority could simply sidestep every case in which we raise the covered by doctrine by simply saying, well, the arbitrator read the contract as creating a duty to bargain without independently making a determination whether, in fact, the contract comprehensively covered the subject matter.
That's just a consequence of the Congress's clear belief that arbitration awards should be not reviewed judicially.
But
it's a consequence of that. Maybe you should go back to Congress and get that fixed. But
well,
that's what Congress says. And, you know, I mean, if you're right about that, then there would just be an enormous exception to the general rule that you don't review decisions of arbitrators.
Well, to the extent that arbitration decisions involve ULPs, Congress has said there can be a review.
Our cases say it doesn't make any difference what the arbitrator rests his or her decision on. What is determinative is what the authority does. And here the authority chose to rest its decision on the arbitrator's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement.
And I would submit that as a result of the way the authority approached this, it can undo.
I understand. I think we're getting repetitive here. I just have one last question, which is I was puzzled about your sovereign immunity argument. Could you just explain how that works?
Well, the award, to the extent that it required accepted service employees to be considered for vacant positions in the competitive service, was coupled with the Back Pay Act award in terms of the remedy. And the Back Pay Act certainly is a waiver of sovereign immunity issue. Right. And so our point was simply that the question of whether, in fact, we had to violate a regulation that would then lead to a back pay award would implicate the sovereign immunity of the United States, and therefore this court has found reason to review those cases.
And you have a case that says that?
Well, I have.
Specifically now a case that, not an unfair labor practice case, but do you have a case where the authority rested its decision on the arbitrator's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement and that we held that was, notwithstanding the statute, reviewable because it would have required the government to violate the statute? Do you have a case that says that?
I'm not aware of
the answer.
Of a case.
Not yet.
Well, it's not yet then. I think the problem with the way this case now exists is that we have the possibility that the authority will never give us our day in court on the covered by doctrine by simply because every arbitration decision is going to have, as it did in Bureau of Prisons, have a contractual side and a statutory, potential statutory side. In Federal Bureau of Prisons, this court had no problem in seeing the coupling of the two, but the contract was not an independent basis separate and apart from the covered by doctrine.
I mean, there are problems with caveating your position and with the other side's position. Under your position, there really isn't any difference anymore. All that the agency needs to do is argue covered by, and there's de novo authority review.
And I don't think covered by comes up as universally as the court's questions seem to suggest. And I would also point out there are specific exceptions like the zipper clauses and reopener clauses, and we had two of those in this case. We pointed to Articles 26 and 28 in the contract, the collective bargaining agreement, which did call for permit bargaining during the midterm as opposed to...
Does covered by come up any time other than in midterm?
That is the defense constructed.
That's the only time it comes
in the midterm bargaining. Yeah. Yes. And it, Judge Edwards' decision in 962 at Second the Marine Logistics traces the genealogy of that development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't go.
Okay. Sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry. Most people don't try to flee the lectern.
I'm way over my time, and that's I was right. Thinking I was abusing it.
That's all right. On this question of consider versus assign, you say in your brief, actually in several places, that if the authority is correct that the CBA, that the arbitrator held the CBA only required the agency to consider and not to assign, then it would be unobjectionable to the agency. Is that right?
If in fact that was the bottom line, yes.
There wouldn't be a sovereign immunity problem under those circumstances.
No, but we faced a similar issue recently, and I think Judge Edwards wrote an opinion in which contractual language that were the parties were seeking to negotiate over involved a should or consider type language, and he pointed out that either it's not bargainable or it puts us at our peril of winding up being, in this case, subject to...
I don't see how it puts you at your peril when the agency itself has interpreted what the arbitrary did as consider rather than assign. How does that put you at your peril?
Well, if in fact it means more than that, and we don't...
But the agency rebutted your argument by saying it doesn't mean more than that, it only means consider. Let's say, in our opinion, we agreed with the agency, with FLRA, that it only means consider and not assign. Then you would not have a sovereign immunity.
And then the decision would be there's no violation of the reg because it doesn't require the regulation to be violated.
But it would make a difference in this case. I mean, the record shows that...
You didn't even consider.
That you didn't even consider, that employees who called and said, you know, I'm pleased to have priority consideration, that the HR specialist said, no, you don't qualify for priority consideration, you're accepted service. And, you know, that's exactly what they're seeking.
Right, and that's because, and that brings back in the sovereign immunity, so maybe the union really thinks it means more than... a somewhat abstract consider. I don't know how we would consider and then reject it because the regulation doesn't permit it and not therefore look like we're violating the award, which says consider. That's why I think it's a problematic.
Is there no difference between, it's not impossible for somebody in the accepted service to get a position, is it?
There are certain, to get a position in the accepted service, but the competitive service involves certain testing.
No, I understand, but it's not, there are various anti-burrowing rules at the end of administrations and such, but otherwise, if all that has to be done is that they be considered, but still have to meet the requirements of the competitive service, that wouldn't be inconsistent with any regulations, would it?
If they had to meet the requirements, yeah. And then they would be applying for a competitive service situation. I would think that sounds right to me, that it's all right.
Okay. Further questions?
No.
Thank you.
But we couldn't just place them in the position pursuant to an order to do so.
May it please the Court. My name is Zachary Hennigy. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. This case involves an arbitration award and that arbitrator's interpretation of the contract. To apply the covered by doctrine in the way the agency suggests would turn upside down the deference that arbitrators are given when interpreting contract language in a collective bargaining agreement. This case is about giving finality to the authority's decision to uphold that arbitrator's decision on that ground, on that contractual interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement.
I know we see this filtered through the limitations of our review of the authority and the standard that the authority applies to the arbitrator, and those are very important filters. But just looking at the contract here, how would you respond to an assertion that the Broadcasting Board of Governors did comply with the text of the collective bargaining agreement? How were they supposed to ascertain that they were obligated to engage in full-fledged I&I bargaining here?
In this situation, in the fall of 2009, when the reduction in force came about, or the potential of the reduction in force came about, the union asked for bargaining. The union sent the letter, contacted the agency, and requested bargaining. The agency refused to sit down with the union. The arbitrator, looking at the language of Article 30, Section 2, and Article 3, where it says that the agency will consider the union's views on mitigation, and we'll sit down and if you look back and link back to Article 3, sit down, bargain, consult before implementation. That part the arbitrator found was required prior to implementing the reduction in force. And what we're talking about here is, even if taking the agency's suggestion that, you know, there were provisions that govern the reduction in force, the arbitrator conceded that, even if it were covered by that, it doesn't resolve the contract interpretation that took place in this case. And that's why on the separate and independent ground, the authority is able to uphold the arbitrator's award. The dispute over the contract and what's going on in the contract still exists.
So their frustration, I think, is let's say they bargain with the union for something that actually pretermits I&I bargaining. It says, we're going to consult with you, yeah, but we're not going to bargain with you. And you get some other concession in exchange for that. You've given away a contractually grounded right to I&I bargaining. And they say, you know, we're going to have a more streamlined process. Fine, going forward. Then you turn around and you reconsider as not just consult, but bargain. And they say, no, that's not what we agreed to. And you said, well, you know, the arbitrator says it is what we agreed to. And they're saying, well, no, in that situation, we need to be able to enforce the fact that we've actually come up with something different. You bargained that away. Why is your position not sort of flushing that opportunity away for them?
It's up to the arbitrator to determine how the contract is interpreted. The authority reviews that with great deference. And looking at this contract and the terms, the arbitrator's award drew the essence from the agreement. It looked at the language in those provisions, Article 30 and Article 3, and it said, okay, maybe that's not perfectly clear. But then looking at the past practice, looking at that extrinsic evidence, 5 years, five different times over the course of a decade, the parties got together, they bargained, and they were able to mitigate the effects of a reduction in force.
So the covered by defense, at least exclusively on the contractual side, just really does fold into the arbitrator interpretation of the contract.
Looking at the number of provisions here of the reduction in force, certainly I can't say that that's not part of the analysis, that you have to look at those and determine, okay, did they bargain this away? I'm sure that was part of the arbitrator's analysis.
Right. And so to the extent that they're saying, but we need to be able to assert a covered by defense on the contract side, you're saying, yeah, you can assert that, but that really is sort of one and the same as arguing to the arbitrator that that's what the contract means. They get that shot, and they don't get a sort of a separate covered by moment where they get the authority to second guess that in the name of it having already been settled.
Correct, Your Honor.
They only get the authority.
Correct, Your Honor.
But the consequence of that is, as Mr. Scherr said, that you're, when they're both basically exactly the same arguments, you're able to avoid judicial review by calling it contractual rather than calling it covered by.
Well, when you call it covered by, that's a defense to the statutory unfair labor practice. And the cases, Association of Civilian Technicians, Overseas Education, AFGE, Local 2510, all these cases, no case has been cited yet that describes that covered by defense applies to anything beyond the statutory ULP. Looking at the arbitrator's decision, we would, again, be turning this completely, the whole analysis upside down, and taking away deference to the arbitrator if every time the agency was able to come in and say, we're going to assert this covered by defense, and now the agency has, or the authority has to review this analysis, the arbitrator's analysis, de novo, and then the court gets to review that again de novo because it's looking at the statute. What happens here is, again, the covered by defense that they raised here is only going to determine whether or not there's a defense to the statutory ULP. And even if there is, you still have to look at the contract and whether or not, for in this case, there was cost study analysis that was violated. There was retraining that was violated. There was this considers, you know, the accepted service into the competitive service. A number of these other parts are still going to be there, even if it does cover by, even if the contract does cover and there's no obligation to bargain.
Is there a difference in consequence if they're found guilty of an unfair labor practice as compared to if they're found to have violated a contractual term?
In this case, there wasn't. There might be, hypothetically, it depends on what the contract says as far as the remedies are concerned. And the arbitrator could fashion remedies, perhaps the parties have bargained away certain remedies.
I'm talking about in the future. Is there a difference if you have a ULP on your record as compared to having a contractual violation?
We have a, and it's in essence a federal offense. You've violated the law instead of maybe a violation of the contract. I don't know if there's some second order of consequences that are related to that.
Is it typical for a remedy of an unfair labor practice to require posting in the workplace, for example, something that might not be supported in the bargaining side?
A typical remedy of a ULP is a notice posting.
And that wouldn't be typically supported in a violation of a collective bargaining agreement?
It depends. There are a number of arbitrators that will award that as part of the, depending on the violation that occurs and what the union seeks as part of the remedy. But here, again, the authority looking at the arbitrator's award didn't find, and the agency hasn't shown, how its finding was irrational, unfounded, or implausible. The authority looked at the contract interpretation, found that drew its essence from the collective bargaining agreement, and didn't need to go further. Based on that, the agency did not show that that award was deficient. There was no need to get into the ULP and statutory violation.
Can I switch to the Article 30, Section 4E issue? I have to say I was confused by the last two pages of your brief, in which you suddenly introduced the word displacement rather than assignment. Are you sticking to that, or would you like to withdraw that?
I don't think it's necessary to get there, Your Honor. The authority...
Well, let me put it this way. I could not, using word search, I could not find anywhere in the authority's argument. In the authority's decision, they rested on the difference between assign and consider, right?
Correct, Your
Honor. Not between displace and consider.
Correct.
And it seems to me those are different, right? Assign could be assigning to a vacant spot, and displace could be taking somebody out of the spot, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I think the key is the authority uses the word vacant, and the agency and the authority both cite the OPM regulation, and the OPM regulation incorporates Section A, Section B that we're talking about here that describes accepted service and competitive service, but it incorporates the first part is A, which includes the language about displacement. But again, I don't think this is necessary because the agency didn't show, doesn't contest. They can see it's unobjectionable as the authority has viewed it, that priority consideration is not assignment, and it doesn't require the agency to assign.
Well, I'm still not following. I read the agency's decision, Flores' decision, as being all that's required is consider. You agree with that?
Yes.
So the difference between assignment and displacement doesn't matter. All that can be required is that they be considered.
That's right. That's right.
When I read the regulation, I'm not seeing exactly how displacement is possible. Part A says an agency may at its discretion adopt provisions which permit a competing employee to displace. But Part B says provisions adopted by an agency under A may not provide for the assignment of an agency in an accepted position to position the competitive service. That seems to contradict your argument. That is, displacement is not possible in the circumstances of somebody going from an accepted to a competitive position.
I'm going to stick with what the authority said, that there's consideration for vacant positions.
I'll consider that withdrawal of those last two pages.
I'm just going to needle on that a little bit more. Consideration is one thing. Priority consideration does seem to include within it some kind of trumping of someone else. So if there's priority consideration being given, then you may not be displacing an incumbent, but you may be displacing someone else in the applicant pool. And is that consistent with your understanding of what priority consideration might mean?
The way the arbitrator described it was it's a first look. That's the priority aspect of the consideration. But if somebody is more competitive, I don't believe that would trump the more competitive person.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Time left? Oh, we have an interviewer. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to forget you.
May it please the Court, my name is Leisha Self, and I'm representing the intervener in this case, American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1812. As counsel for the FLRA argued, lack of jurisdiction, and that this case does not involve an unfair labor practice and does not force the government to be sued without its consent, I won't belabor that point. I wanted to use a little bit of my time to point out some of the equities in this case and how they impact on this court's jurisdiction. The people involved in this case and the work that they did for the agency really represent one of the primary reasons that Congress intended for the FLRA to be the final reviewing authority of an arbitration award when a ULP is not involved in the FLRA review. The people are 16 employees, some 14 of whom have not worked for the agency since December of 2009, now over 4 years, and with really disastrous consequences for some. And they performed significant work for the agency, and it was work that the agency needed. The arbitrator in the case found, and the authority acknowledged, that they weren't separated for correct RIF reasons, that is, lack of work or lack of funds. They were instead separated because the director of the Office of Cuba Broadcasting was retaliating against them for their criticisms against him involving fraud and abuse, and it had resulted in some very negative reports to Congress. So the union and the employees were relying on the collective bargaining agreement to protect them. But unfortunately, the agency complied with almost none of the contractual requirements that it agreed to for RIFs, including bargaining over impact and including finding other work for the employees or trying to. Nevertheless, the employees believed that they had a speedy and efficient resolution system to address the violations, what the union had contracted for, the negotiated grievance procedure. And the speed and efficiency of the grievance...
This may seem a little far afield, but were there any whistleblower claims or anything filed out of this? Any actual, you know, claims that these people were retaliated against for their critique of the Office of Cuba Broadcasting?
Not as part of this arbitration.
But is that something that's separately available? I'm just curious.
I believe, but I may be incorrect, that some of the employees filed whistleblower complaints to the MSPB. Yes. The speed and efficiency of the grievance and arbitration process is really a significant reason Congress created the one level of review, FLRA review, for arbitration awards that don't involve a ULP in the FLRA review. And whereas here the agency seeks to draw out the process by presenting this contract violation case to the instant court, Congress's intent in creating the single layer of review for arbitration awards, the speedy and efficient processing, is thwarted.
But can I just interject here? Maybe I'm missing something, but this speediness could, in another case, hurt your client, correct? This could easily come around and bite you on the other side. In this case, the arbitrator said that the contractual language was not clear, right, and relied on the parole evidence rule, right?
That's correct.
So imagine that the same arbitrator, or another twin arbitrator, had instead said, yeah, it's unclear, and I'm not going to apply the parole evidence rule, and the union loses, the grievance loses. Then the FLRA would not be able to review that determination under your theory, right? They have to have extreme deference to the arbitrator's decision, right?
I think that the FLRA would have the opportunity to review, as the FLRA has the opportunity to review arbitration awards.
But they have very limited review of an arbitrator's determination of the meaning of a contract, right?
Yes.
And we have no, under what you're saying, we have no review, right?
Interpretation cases.
Yes. So if you had drawn a, quote, bad arbitrator, bad from your point of view, this approach that you're arguing for, and it could happen tomorrow, will actually hurt your clients, correct? Not these particular ones in front of you today, but other employees.
I think it depends, Your Honor, on what you mean by hurt.
They would lose.
Yeah. Okay. And then they would have a result that they could move forward from.
So it's more important to move forward than to win?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor.
Imagine we always get it right. And imagine your clients are always right. You would be depriving your clients of the opportunity of our review to get it right.
That's right, but I'm not arguing for what I hope for in an ideal world. I'm pointing out what Congress's balance was when it struck its balance. And of course, I prefer to win, but I am not Congress, and Congress made this determination.
The balance is when you started out by saying that this has to do with the equities of this situation and the employees, the way in which Congress has structured it is not pro-employee or pro-employer. Either both of them get speedy result this way, but on the substantive result, neither of them get de novo review or, I shouldn't say de novo, the normal kind of more searching review you would do, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I guess I perhaps should bring in the notion that Congress was really looking at with all of the labor relations law, which is industrial peace. Mm-hmm. And part of industrial peace
getting resolved.
Is getting resolution. Okay. Yeah.
Further questions? No. All right. Thank you. Time left, we'll give you another 2 minutes for a vote.
Thank you, Your Honor. The closest case, I think, to the one you've been asking me about contract interpretation, was the Federal Bureau of Prisons case, which rose out of an arbitration decision, came before this court, involved an arbitrator's decision that there was both a contractual and statutory violation. And the authority, at some point in the case, tried to decouple and say that the contractual finding was separate and apart on an independent basis. And the argumentation in that case, and the court rejected, I think, ultimately, that they were decoupled because it said the arbitrator didn't see them as separate. But nevertheless, it points out that the authority will, and in that case, I should add, we won because the court agreed with us that a provision dealing with assignments covered the particular assignment program that had just been started, mission critical in that case. Had the authority's view of limiting how the court gets to review covered by doctrine prevailed in that case, we would have been stuck with a contractual decision by the arbitrator that found that we had to engage once again in midterm bargaining over something we thought we had already bargained over.
But isn't there a critical difference there, Mr. Scherr, in that in the Bureau of Prisons case, the discussion, the authority explicitly addressed the unfair labor practice in its decision?
And ultimately, the question arose on rehearing, but then it didn't go any further than rehearing, whether in fact this was the contractual decision was a separate and independent basis. And I commend the court to take a look at that. rehearing petitions in the case, because I think it backs up my point that it's easy enough for the authority.
Did we decide the rehearing petition?
It was denied.
Well, that usually doesn't.
I'm aware of that, Your Honor, but I think the point about the fact that these things generally arise in tandem, both the contractual and the statutory, when covered by is asserted, allows the authority to choose one over the other, and as a gatekeeper, prevents us from getting to court where this court actually corrected the problem.
Although there's potential, some might argue, I take your point that it feels like there's some arbitrariness there, or maybe even incentives to protect, for the authority to protect its decisions from judicial review by the way it frames them. And that I take that to be your concern. On the other hand, the authority is not making law on the statutory issues. And that's the justification, I think, for the lack of our jurisdiction, or where it does make law on the statutory questions, why we do have jurisdiction.
And then a problem arises, as identified by Judge Edwards, I think, in the 399F third case. Well, then you just have contracts that are the starting point for negotiation, and we never finish. And there has to be, as Judge Edwards said on page 60 of that decision, had the parties in that case engaged in bargaining that resulted in the provision that actually was in the collective bargaining agreement, but they had done it at midterm bargaining, nobody would have said the agency didn't comply with its duty to bargain. And that's what I would urge here. The same thing that wound up in Article 30, had that been negotiated out midterm, nobody would argue that that was insufficient to meet our midterm bargaining obligation had there been nothing prior to Article 30, and then Article 30 results from midterm bargaining. And that's the important point, that the statutory duty to bargain is general. We always have a statutory duty to bargain, but the authority in this court have recognized for legal policy and other reasons that the duty to bargain midterm has to be limited. And in this case, we didn't get a shot before the authority of getting our argument out as to why the arbitrator's consideration of the cover by doctrine was an error. And to conclude, I think that's a matter that the authority should have taken de novo based on, I understand, cases that didn't involve arbitration, but do involve the policy involved here of stability and repose in
regarding. Do we have further questions?
No.
We'll take matter under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both.
Thank you for the additional time.